Chapter 30. Madness gleamed from them like fire. We sat in silence for a few minutes. He spoke at last. My recent dissipation, and strange remarks, made so soon after his sister's death, were an insult to her memory. Coupling together many circumstances which had at first escaped his observation, he thought I had not treated her well. He wished to know whether he was right in inferring that I meant to cast a reproach upon her memory and a disrespect upon her family. It was due to the uniform he wore to demand this explanation. This man had a commission in the army, a commission purchased with my money and his sister's misery. This was the man who had been foremost in the plot to ensnare me and grasp my wealth. This was the man who had been the main instrument in forcing his sister to wed me, well knowing that her heart was given to that puling boy. Due to his uniform, the livery of his degradation, I turned my eyes upon him. I could not help it, but I spoke not a word. I saw the sudden change that came upon him beneath my gaze. He was a bold man, but the color faded from his face, and he drew back his chair. I dragged mine nearer to him, and I laughed. I was very merry. Then I saw him shudder. I felt the madness rising within me. He was afraid of me. "You were very fond of your sister when she was alive," I said. "Very." He looked uneasily round him, and I saw his hand grasp the back of his chair, but he said nothing. "You villain," said I found you out. I discovered your hellish plots against me. I know her heart was fixed on someone else before you compelled her to marry me. I know it. He jumped suddenly from his chair, brandished it aloft, and bid me stand back, for I took care to be getting closer to him all the time I spoke. I screamed rather than talked, for I felt tumultuous passions eddying through my veins, and the old spirits whispering and taunting me to tear his heart out. "Damn you," said I, starting up and rushing upon him. "I killed her. I am a madman. Down with you. Blood, blood. I will have it." I turned aside with one blow the chair he hurled at me in his terror, and closed with him, and with a heavy crash we rolled upon the floor together. It was a fine struggle that, for he was a tall, strong man, fighting for his life, and I, a powerful madman, thirsting to destroy him. I knew no strength could equal mine, and I was right. Right again, though a madman. His struggles grew fainter. I knelt upon his chest, and clasped his brawny throat firmly with both hands. His face grew purple, his eyes were starting from his head, and with protruded tongue, he seemed to mock me. I squeezed the tighter. The door was suddenly burst open with a loud noise, and a crowd of people rushed forward, crying aloud to each other to secure the madman. My secret was out, and my only struggle now was for liberty and freedom. I gained my feet before a hand was on me, threw myself among my assailants, and cleared my way with my strong arm, as if I bore a hatchet in my hand, and hewed them down before me. I gained the door, dropped over the banisters, and in an instant was in the street. Straight and swift I ran, and no one dared to stop me. I heard the noise of the feet behind, and redoubled my speed. It grew fainter and fainter in the distance, and at length died away altogether. But on I bounded, through marsh and rivulet, over fence and wall, with a wild shout which was taken up by the strange beings that flocked around me on every side, and swelled the sound, till it pierced the air. I was borne upon the arms of demons who swept along upon the wind, and bore down bank and hedge before them, and spun me round and round with a rustle and a speed that made my head swim, until at last they threw me from them with a violent shock, and I fell heavily upon the earth. When I woke I found myself here in this gray cell, where the sunlight seldom comes, and the moon steals in rays which only serve to show the dark shadows about me, and that silent figure in its old corner. When I lie awake, I can sometimes hear strange shrieks and cries from distant parts of this large place. What they are, I know not, but they neither come from that pale form, nor does it regard them. For from the first shades of dusk till the earliest light of morning, it still stands motionless in the same place, listening to the music of my iron chain, and watching my gambols on my straw bed. Apostrophe, at the end of the manuscript was written, in another hand, this note. The unhappy man whose ravings are recorded above, was a melancholy instance of the baneful results of energies misdirected in early life, and excesses prolonged until their consequences could never be repaired. The thoughtless riot, dissipation, and debauchery of his younger days produced fever and delirium. The first effects of the latter was the strange delusion, founded upon a well-known medical theory, strongly contended for by some, and as strongly contested by others, that an hereditary madness existed in his family. This produced a settled gloom, which in time developed a morbid insanity, and finally terminated in raving madness. There is every reason to believe that the events he detailed, though distorted in the description by his diseased imagination, really happened. It is only matter of wonder to those who were acquainted with the vices of his early career, that his passions, when no longer controlled by reason, did not lead him to the commission of still more frightful deeds.
Mr. Pickwick's candle was just expiring in the socket, as he concluded the perusal of the old clergyman's manuscript. And when the light went suddenly out, without any previous flicker by way of warning, it communicated a very considerable start to his excited frame. Hastily throwing off such articles of clothing as he had put on when he rose from his uneasy bed, and casting a fearful glance around, he once more scrambled hastily between the sheets, and soon fell fast asleep. The sun was shining brilliantly into his chamber when he awoke, and the morning was far advanced. The gloom which had oppressed him on the previous night had disappeared with the dark shadows which shrouded the landscape, and his thoughts and feelings were as light and gay as the morning itself. After a hearty breakfast, the four gentlemen sallied forth to walk to Gravesend, followed by a man bearing the stone in its steel box. They reached the town about 1 o'clock. Their luggage they had directed to be forwarded to the city, from Rochester, and being fortunate enough to secure places on the outside of a coach, arrived in London in sound health and spirits, on that same afternoon. The next 3 or 4 days were occupied with the preparations which were necessary for their journey to the borough of Etansville. As any references to that most important undertaking demands a separate chapter, we may devote the few lines which remain at the close of this, to narrate, with great brevity, the history of the antiquarian discovery. It appears from the transactions of the club, then, that Mr. Pickwick lectured upon the discovery at a general club meeting, convened on the night succeeding their return, and entered into a variety of ingenious and erudite speculations on the meaning of the inscription. It also appears that a skillful artist executed a faithful delineation of the curiosity, which was engraven on stone, and presented to the Royal Antiquarian Society and other learned bodies. That heartburnings and jealousies without number were created by rival controversies which were penned upon the subject, and that Mr. Pickwick himself wrote a pamphlet, containing 96 pages of very small print, and 27 different readings of the inscription. That 3 old gentlemen cut off their eldest sons with a shilling apiece for presuming to doubt the antiquity of the fragment, and that 1 enthusiastic individual cut himself off prematurely, in despair at being unable to fathom its meaning. That Mr. Pickwick was elected an honorary member of 17 native and foreign societies, for making the discovery. That none of the 17 could make anything of it, but that all the 17 agreed it was very extraordinary. Mr. Blotton, indeed, and the name will be doomed to the undying contempt of those who cultivate the mysterious and the sublime. Mr. Blotton, we say, with the doubt and cavilling peculiar to vulgar minds, presumed to state a view of the case, as degrading as ridiculous. Mr. Blotton, with a mean desire to tarnish the luster of the immortal name of Pickwick, actually undertook a journey to Cobham in person, and on his return, sarcastically observed in an oration at the club, that he had seen the man from whom the stone was purchased, that the man presumed the stone to be ancient, but solemnly denied the antiquity of the inscription inasmuch as he represented it to have been rudely carved by himself in an idle mood, and to display letters intended to bear neither more or less than the simple construction of Bill Stumps, his mark, and that Mr. Stumps, being little in the habit of original composition, and more accustomed to be guided by the sound of words than by the strict rules of orthography, had omitted the concluding L of his Christian name. The Pickwick Club, as might have been expected from so enlightened an institution, received this statement with the contempt it deserved, expelled the presumptuous and ill-conditioned Blotton from the society, and voted Mr. Pickwick a pair of gold spectacles, in token of their confidence and approbation. In return for which, Mr. Pickwick caused a portrait of himself to be painted, and hung up in the club room. Mr. Blotton was ejected but not conquered. He also wrote a pamphlet, addressed to the 17 learned societies, native and foreign, containing a repetition of the statement he had already made, and rather more than half intimating his opinion that the 17 learned societies were so many humbugs. Apostrophe hereupon, the virtuous indignation of the 17 learned societies being roused, several fresh pamphlets appeared. The foreign learned societies corresponded with the native learned societies. The native learned societies translated the pamphlets of the foreign learned societies into English. The foreign learned societies translated the pamphlets of the native learned societies into all sorts of languages. And thus commenced that celebrated scientific discussion so well known to all men, as the Pickwick controversy. But this base attempt to injure Mr. Pickwick recoiled upon the head of its calumnious author. The 17 learned societies unanimously voted the presumptuous Blotton an ignorant meddler, and forthwith set to work upon more treatises than ever. And to this day the stone remains, an illegible monument of Mr. Pickwick's greatness, and a lasting trophy to the littleness of his enemies. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.